Brian Had a Dream, 10,000 movies, 40 years. This is his journey, and this is your invitation to join along. This is the quest for 10,000.
I'm Ben.
And I'm Brian.
And welcome once again, everybody, to the quest for 10,000, our audio journey with Brian as he tries to watch 10,000 movies before he turns 40. Thank you once again for joining in, listening in, and sharing this podcast with anyone you may know. Happy New Year, everybody. We say goodbye to 2016.
We say good riddance to 2016.
Amen. And we look back at 2016 through the lens of some of the films that Brian and perhaps I also saw, and maybe start to think a little bit about what 2017 might bring. Our top five this week will be Brian's top five movies that remind him of the year that was. We want you also to be part of the conversation, so check us out on Twitter at 10K Movies, T-E-N-K Movies, or on Brian's blog, 10kmovies.com. And on Brian's blog, you can see how many movies he's seen so far. But for those who maybe are just checking us out right now, Brian, tell everyone what number movie you're on.
7,438.
And the last movie that you saw, which would probably be the first movie you've seen in 2017, was?
It was a TV movie from 2015 with Anthony Hopkins and Ian McKellen, The Dresser.
A TV movie. Was that a network or?
It's on Stars.
Okay. And what is The Dresser about?
Well, it's a remake of a movie from the mid-80s with Tom Courtenay and Albert Finney, which was a play. And it's about a guy who is more or less dying. And I don't know that the original movie was set. This movie was set during World War II, but he's part of a touring theater troupe putting on King Lear, and he's losing his mind backstage. And Ian McKellen is his dresser, the guy that keeps him in costume and that kind of stuff. So it was good.
So very meta, it sounds like.
Somewhat.
So hopefully it was good.
It was nominated for a couple of Golden Globes at the ceremony next week, for this upcoming weekend.
So hopefully that's a good omen for the films you might see in 2017. As we think about films in 2016, it strikes me that there's kind of two lines that we could explore here with you, Brian. The first is simply movies that came out in 2016. Uh-huh. And what you thought of those, what ones stood out, whether that means they were really good or they were really bad. Or we could also just talk about movies that came out in any year, but that you watched for the first time in 2016. So maybe we'll start there just to name some of the more memorable films you've seen. And let's start in that category first of movies that came out in 2016. Share with us couple of movies that were just really great and a couple of movies that stand out because they were really bad.
Well, as far as I'm going to start with the really good movies, the ones that I really enjoyed from this past year. My favorite movie as of now, there's always a lot of things that come out at the end of the year that take a little while to filter through for us to see, but it's Rogue One. Rogue One is number one right now.
Which we talked about in our last episode.
We did, and so I'm not going to rehash that. Some of these I have already spoken a little bit about. I like Deadpool quite a bit. I like the O.J. Simpson miniseries, O.J. Made in America. That was very good. I liked Arrival. And I liked this movie about LBJ called All the Way with Bryan Cranston as LBJ. I enjoyed that. So that's some of the good stuff. As far as the utter shite, I'm trying to think of something right now off the top of my head that was just really, really bad that came out in this year.
Well, it may be that you're just trying to put like so much of 2016 out of your memory.
I am.
You mentioned saying good riddance to 2016. How would you maybe rather than talk about the movies that you didn't like so much in 2016, how would you describe 2016 kind of in general and kind of particularly from the world of film? How would you describe both of those things?
Well, you know, it feels, just on the surface of it, it does feel like that it was a year of kind of a passing the torch kind of year in a lot of ways. Because I know that, and this is not just germane to music, to movies, but also I know it feels this way as music, because I know people talk about the sheer number of rock legends that passed away this year. And part of the reason for that is self-evident in what you just said, legends. When you get to the status of being legendary, chances are you've already had a lengthy career, so you're probably creeping up in the, you know, your pedometer has gotten pretty far. So you expect at some point for those people to start, you know, shuffling off into the next plane. So a part of that, I think, is just the natural process of we're at an age now where all those people from that were born in the 40s and 50s that we as children grew up and saw, and we just sort of had this feeling in the back of our mind they'd be with us forever. We're starting to come face to face with the reality that is never going to happen.
Right. Yeah. Passing the torch seems like a very transitional time in terms of pop culture and that sort of thing. You know, a lot of stuff that was good, but maybe not so much that stands out as maybe an all-time great, all-time classic.
Well, and I think
the exception maybe is Rogue One, but that, you know, will take some time to settle.
Yeah. Well, I think Deadpool could be a real turning point because of the way it legitimized the like combining of raunchy comedy films and comic book films. We haven't seen that kind of mashup of those two. I mean, there've been raunchy films like American Pie, Porky's movie. Those films have been successful in their own little thing, but to combine those with the behemoth of superhero marketing and combine that together and you know, it could, we don't know, but that's a possibility. I do think it seemed like, even though the movie was okay and I enjoyed it, it does feel like the shimmer is a little bit off of the Harry Potter franchise. It feels like Fantastic Beasts was just, it was a decent entry, but it didn't feel like it ever got any hype that where where it really broke through into the clutter of pop culture consciousness.
Yeah, so
it was weird.
Passing the torch, transitional, that's nice ways of saying it. I think also, and this goes beyond movies in many ways, feels like just a gut punch year.
It does.
Gut punch to me defines 2016 on many, many levels, particularly as you were talking about some of the losses have been experienced
of
legends.
Culturally and politically, I think we live in a time where everything we thought that was just rock solid foundational wisdom is now up in the air, and we just don't know what of that is going to be true going forward and we can rely on. So it does feel chaotic, disordered, and, you know, and you're starting to see towards the end of the year, you're starting to see movies sort of accommodate that sort of like total confusion and just sort of, you know, unease. But you haven't really seen it yet because the movies that made now were made, you know, under the... So it'll be interesting to see how films, and I think television will be the first place as the shows start to come back in January, February, where they try to address some of the realities that we now face that they couldn't have done before. And we'll see how, A, tactful they are and how artistic they are and how much they just want to scream at somebody. And, you know, it'll be real interesting to see that dynamic play out throughout the course of the year with some of the films we wind up getting next December.
Well, and you mentioned films in next December, and that makes me think that there's one particular gut punch we need to take a little bit of time and talk about, and that is the death of Carrie Fisher, Princess Leia, who was CGI'd in Rogue One, will be in Episode 8. It'll come out December of 17. Will be, I guess, her last filmed movie role.
I think
And that's, I think, again, Carrie Fisher's death probably emblematic of this year, in that it just felt like a gut punch on one level. And another level, hearing that she'd had a heart attack at age 60, knowing some of her history with drug abuse, also not particularly surprising. It wasn't the type of thing where she was taken way too young. But then I think magnified also by her mother, Debbie Reynolds, passing away.
But here's the thing about Carrie. Later. If Carrie had died 3 years ago, okay, before Force Awakens, I don't think you would have this outpouring. It would still have it, but I don't think it would have near of the gut punch factor that it has now. It's the timing of when she died, I think, that is really magnifies its significance.
Well,
because it feels like Star Wars is back, and now she's gone.
And put her back in the spotlight.
Yeah.
And you were saying something interesting. We were talking about this, you know, in the wake of her death, and that she seemed to be maybe a really underrated,
incredibly underrated
performer. So
yeah,
talk a little bit more about that. And
well, she had
about Debbie Reynolds passing as well.
Well, Carrie had for years been brought in as a script doctor to punch up scripts, and that work usually goes uncredited or anonymous. But she'd been doing that for a while, because her wit and her humor was just off the charts. She was an incredibly funny lady, and I do feel like that for whatever reason, and some of it no doubt is a little bit of misogyny in the way in which we treat women, in the way in which she got stigmatized in some ways as a sex object. You know, and despite the fact that this was now 30 years ago and she looks very little like the woman that she did in Star Wars, or in, you know, she's aged considerably because it's been 40 years. But yet still, that is the image I think people have in their minds when they think Carrie Fisher. And that's difficult, you know, because she made a joke about how, you know, the day of her mother's death, I was watching her one woman show, Wishful Drinking, on HBO. And she made a joke about how that she went into this store and this guy said, "Oh, you're Carrie Fisher. You know, I thought of you every day when I was growing up." And she said, "Really? Every day?" He's like, "Yeah, sometimes two or three times a day." And she's like, "I don't know if I should thank you." She's like, "Thanks, no. I guess." You know, so but she, you know, she talked about that. But the reality is that most people wouldn't say something like that to her. But a lot of people felt that way about her, in a sense, that she was sort of trapped as this image that they had in their minds, and that was all she was. That's all they needed her to be. So they didn't care what else encompassed, you know, what else she was capable of. And, you know, if she had chosen to just never go in front of a camera and had just chosen to try to be a writer director, you know, I see a lot of similarities in her work in some ways to what Penny Marshall did. Because, right. You know, it's very acerbic and very has a distinct point of view. But also with her, you know, she has because of her position of being inside a fair many of Hollywood, not necessarily scandals, but Hollywood back, you know, she's a part of Hollywood just in general, that she has all these connections. She can make interesting observations and characters about the way Hollywood works that I don't think many people have that sort of vantage point.
Yeah, all I can add, I think, to her talents that you've said is, as memorable as she is in Star Wars, the role I kind of think, maybe not first, but second with her, is in the Blues Brothers as Jake's ex-fiance. And just the comedic timing and
well, she probably got to do more. She probably got to do more in that, you know, as far as just range than she did in any of the Star Wars. Because the Star Wars movies, the dialogue is incredibly wooden. I mean, that didn't, you know, the problem people have with the prequels were there in the original trilogy. I mean, the writing is very, very on point and not very subtle and very sometimes difficult to hear. You know, you listen to it and you're like, cringeworthy. Right. But, you know, it works in part because I don't think we understand how incredibly talented and charming her and Mark Hamill and Harrison were, and Alec Guinness. And it just, it worked because of who was reading those words, you know, not because of the words. But
Gut Punch number one, as 2016 came to a close, Carrie Fisher, Gut Punch number two, her mother, Debbie Reynolds.
Yeah, you know, Debbie's career, you know, for most of people my age and probably up to maybe 40, I don't think her career, you remember Singing in the Rain, but I think fewer and fewer people do, because I think it kind of, it gets one of those movies that you know of, but not necessarily too many people have seen. You know what I'm saying? It's like one of the movies, you know that's famous, but I don't know that I've actually seen it. But she was wonderful in it. But that movie's about spectacle. It's not necessarily about the people involved. But when I think of Debbie, I think of this movie from the late 90s she did with Albert Brooks called Mother.
Oh, yeah. That was great.
Where she was, playing kind of an exaggerated portion, portrayal of her relationship maybe with her children, where she's always kind of overbearing and always comparing their failures and talking about their failures and focusing on that, making them feel.
And Albert Brooks, and yeah, is the bewildered straight man that he basically is copyrighted his career. Yeah, that was a really funny movie.
You know, Debbie Reynolds too. To hear Carrie tell it, Debbie had, even considering everything she'd been through, she had a certain naivete about how the world worked, even though, you know, she's 80 years old and you would think she's seen it all. At one point, when she was talking about Debbie, you know, Debbie's first husband left her for Elizabeth Taylor. And then her second and third husbands were wealthy, but then they wound up taking her money from her. But at one point, Carrie had this great line about one of the guys that she married. She goes, he was what we call distinguished looking, which really, if you know, what that means translated is, he's ugly but rich. She just so full of like point on observations.
Yeah,
that's just incredible. Well,
and we will miss that insight. Our thoughts and prayers definitely go out to the Fisher and Reynolds family. Well, and
Carrie Fisher's daughter. I can't imagine what her daughter, like how Billy Lord. I can't imagine what that sort of a 1-2 punch would do to somebody. I do pray for her. Yeah.
Well, since gut punch does seem to define it, but also like the idea of passing on the torch and even something is kind of dear in some ways too, of maybe a mother dying of a broken heart. There's something emotionally resonant about that, and increases maybe the sense of loss that we have, but also reminds us, hey, we're human. Those kind of themes are rolling around in my head right now. It makes it seem like we should probably wait till our next episode to talk maybe more about the hopeful optimism that 2017 could potentially bring to us. And instead, move on to a top five. And for our top five in this episode, to talk about the movies that maybe are most emblematic of 2016. So the movies that capture that theme of gut punch or passing on the torch or, a sense of loss, something like that. Movies that are emblematic of 2016. So it's kind of an ubiquitous category, I know, Brian, but also know you've seen so many movies, you can be up to the task. So top five movies that will remind us of 2016, not necessarily released in 2016.
Okay, number five. I'm going with, a big picture kind of idea here. And number five movie that sort of reminds me of what 2016 kind of encapsulates the year is Being There. It's a movie with Peter Sellers, and it's a movie about a guy who accidentally sort of assumes the position of power. He does this. Anyhow, it's a great movie, very funny. And that's number five. Number four, The Madness of King George. about a guy.
Chaotic, who, yes.
Yeah. And he sort of isn't aware that he's losing his mind.
Right.
And he's sort of slowly descending into madness. Well,
and in 2016, King George got a little bit of an extra shine with Jonathan Groff's portrayal in the musical Hamilton. So
yeah, oh yeah,
yeah, that's good. That's nice. Yeah,
another movie. This movie, I think, pretty much is like a blueprint for what happened in 2016. A movie came out in 1976, Network. And it's a guy who just, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it any more. And about how television and those little snippets of raw emotion are so powerful.
Now, if there is a movie that is ripe for a really crappy new version, remake, it's Network, but centered around social media
and fake news.
And all that sort of stuff. It's there, and it would be crappy, but it probably needs to be made.
Well, and the thing about it is, even in Network, there were allusions to fake news even then, because it was like they were going to film an assassination, and it's like, it nails what happened. One movie I think this has been done, but I'm going to say this because I think it bears repeating. Idiocracy was increasingly looks like a documentary about the situation. I mean, it just does.
I'm noticing a political theme also to your movie picks.
This is not a knock on any particular political candidate. That is not. I'm not saying that this is because of Trump or because of Hillary or because of anything like that. What I'm saying is because of the way in which we have shrunk our politics and our ideas down into these just catchphrases that no one really means or knows anything. It's just code words. And that is what Idiocracy pointed us towards. It's just the dumbing down of everything.
Yeah, but if it means that Terry Crews becomes our president at some
president
point.
President Camacho?
I'm kind of okay with that.
Well, you know, now after the election recently, you know, The Rock has said he's interested in, and people are laughing, and that is to their detriment. Because The Rock is so incredibly charismatic, I guarantee you that he can work a crowd. But if you get him in front of, and if he's semi-coherent, which apparently you don't have to be, but if he's semi-coherent on any issue, I think he could really get some momentum for something.
And with that, we move to the number one movie that reminds you of 2016.
Well, you know, I'm going to go out on a limb, and I'm going to say a movie that was reviled by many. Just like this year has been reviled by many. But ultimately, if you look hard enough, you can see the seeds of hope and love and unity, and that is Cloud Atlas.
A movie that only you love.
Only I love. But I do. I love it. And, you know, and I know it's chaotic, and in some ways I understand that it is a big mess, but I also love the fact that the movie preaches a message of that love can conquer, that love is greater than its enemies, and I think we need that message sorely and desperately.
Well, what a lovely, lovely notion to end our podcast on for this episode. Listeners, tell us what you think of 2016, just the year or the year in movies, by going to Twitter at 10KTE. At 10K, T-E-N-K Movies, or visiting Brian's blog, 10kmovies.com. We will come back to you in a couple of weeks with our next episode, and maybe hopefully focusing more on that theme of love that we so desperately need as we look to 2017 and those movies. In 2017, we'll say briefly, we're hoping that we can continue our streak of coming to you at least twice a month, and also maybe increasing our push on social media and in other ways to see who is out there and engage listeners maybe a little bit more. So be on the lookout for maybe some new developments along those lines as the quest for 10,000 continues. But until that happens, we hope that your week is a 10.
10 plus.
Border 9-11.